AT&T Radio wants you to get on our soapbox because your opinion matters. Tell us what you really think at tntradio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. Exploring solutions to the mental health crisis. This is Mind Medicine on today's news talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to the Mind Medicine program in association with a wonderful charity, Mind Medicine Australia. I'm Charles Coves, Australasia's passion provocateur, and this is a place of passion. This show is all about how and why mind matters, your mind, and matters relating to your mind. It's about giving you ideas to provoke new ways about thinking about your life and life generally. We explore insights into mental health issues and health issues of all descriptions, and we're delighted to be here in association with Mind Medicine Australia. And I want to tell you a little bit about this wonderful charity that was started some years ago here in Melbourne, Australia. And in Melbourne, Australia, it's now 4 p.m. So that means it's 9 p.m. Friday night in Los Angeles, and it's 5 a.m. on my reckoning in London and 6 a.m. in Europe. Now, Mind Medicine Australia is Australia's leading not-for-profit organisation working on the use of medicinal psilocybin and MDMA-assisted therapies to treat a range of mental illnesses. Mind Medicine Australia exists to help alleviate the suffering caused by our accelerating mental illness epidemic in Australia and around the world through expanding the treatment options available to medical practitioners and their patients. The website is mindmedicineaustralia.org.au. Unlike current treatments such as antidepressants, which only manage the illness and can have nasty side effects, psilocybin and MDMA-assisted therapies have been scientifically proven to be a safe and effective cure for anxiety, depression, end-of-life stress, addictions, and post-traumatic stress disorder after just a short treatment program. These medicines are also currently being researched for dementia, eating disorders, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and a range of other conditions. Research from over 160 trials indicates that medicines are safe and non-addictive when administered within a medically controlled environment and lead to remissions in 60 to 80% of patients after just 2 to 3 medicinal sessions in combination with psychotherapy. There have been no adverse events in over 3,000 patients, unlike the jabs that have been given for COVID. Both medicines have been granted breakthrough therapy status by the FDA to fast-track their approval. This designation is only given to medicines which may prove to be vastly superior to existing treatments. Mind Medicine Australia is dedicated to helping the rapidly emerging global movement to spread awareness and ensure these medicines are available to those who desperately need them via the medical system. So please visit its website, mindmedicineaustralia.org.au, and spread the word. Your family and friends and their friends need these solutions to their mental health challenges. Now, this show is also about passion and its impact on your life and your health. And I want to put it to you that when you are pursuing your passion, your mental health improves dramatically. And if you don't know what your passion is, your job is to work it out. Your job is to find it. Your job is to keep looking, not to give up. And passion, in my books, Passionate People Produce and Passionate Performance, I explore what this wonderful resource is that each one of us has. It's a source of unlimited energy from your soul. And when you have unlimited energy, you are capable of amazing things. So stick around. We hope to inspire you to look for your passion, to discover it, or to find the courage to pursue your passion, to not be locked in to limited ways of thinking. Now, my guest for this 2 hours today. In the first hour is Ian Burns, who I will introduce shortly. And in the second hour, I've got Bob Chemnitz. And Bob is, well, they're both amazing gentlemen. That's why I only have amazing guests on this show. But we go for the full hour with Ian and then with Bob Chemnitz. So stick around. Now, before we get to Ian, I want to make a couple of comments on what's happening here in Melbourne, here in Australia. And regular listeners of the show would know this, but from my perspective, the Victorian election held last week was a massive disaster in the sense that Daniel Andrews, the Premier, the worst Premier in this state's history, in my opinion, was re-elected. And you go, how could that be possible in the lockdown capital of the world? And the simple answer is, and you can quote me on this and quote this number, at least 60% of Victorians and Australians have had a good time under COVID lockdowns. Isn't that a remarkable number? And in a democracy, 60% who are having a good time outvote 40% who are having a dreadful time. And who are the 60%? Well, the 60%, surprise, surprise, are the politicians, are the staff of those politicians, are the bureaucrats, are the public servants, are the first responders. You see, some 35% of Australia's workforce, of Victoria's workforce, are on the public tit. They're being fed by taxpayers. And so none of them lost their jobs. None of them lost their incomes. And then big business. So you look at the big supermarkets, Coles, Woolworths, Bunnings, Dan Murphy's, all of the liquor outlets. They all boomed. And indeed, you look at the stock price over the COVID lockdown. Gosh, I know investors who have had the best time of their lives while all this has been going on. So you can understand why a dictator, why a psychopath, why a corrupt criminal politician like Daniel Andrews gets re-elected. And that's what I want everybody to think about, to go, gosh, it might be all right for you, but what's it doing to 40% of the state? The other element that came out from the election is the total lack of powerful policies from the Liberal Party. And it is my prediction that the Liberal Party will split into two. It is hopelessly conflicted. I've had lots to do with the Liberal Party. Hopelessly conflicted between real conservatives, real freedom warriors like me, and those who are what I call teal liberals or woke liberals who want to suck up to everybody just to appeal to everybody. The other issue I want to touch on before Ian Burns joins me is the stresses of life, the mental challenges. And, you know, the three biggies right now, and you heard it on the news, and Patrick Henningsen's wonderful minute with Patrick, interest rates are going up, having a big impact on people's lives. Food shortages are being predicted in Europe and America, and energy shortages because of a scam climate emergency. And then the EU destroying its whole system of this of governance on this whole creating this manufactured energy shortage tied into this climate emergency. You mark my words, how many people are going to be dying in Europe from this corrupt decision making? And there are globalist agendas behind these pressures. And what's going to happen, what the globalist game is to put people under pressure so then they beg the government to save them. Well, you're on TNT Radio here to understand that you don't want government to save you. You want to save yourself. You want to be in great space so that you are passionate about fighting for your freedom. And TNT Radio is a place where that message keeps being repeated loud and clear. So I'm delighted to have you here, whether you're listening live or on a recording. Now, Ian Burns is a genius, in my opinion. Let me tell you a little bit about Ian. Ian, I just want to check that you're there. Are you there?
Yeah, yes, Charles.
Ah, good. Well, let me say some nice things about you.
Thank you.
Well, Ian Burns has had a long life, and I've been dealing with him for some years. I'll tell you about that a bit later. But Ian's had a long life in the public sphere as a teacher, educational leader, project developer, and writer. Professionally, he wrote two country papers on behalf of Australia for UNESCO conferences and has produced commercials for Victorian TAFE colleges. T-A-F-E stands for Technical and Further Education. It's a post-school, more technical college rather than a university. Ian has written numerous sketches and co-wrote a couple of reviews for the amateur stage. His fiction writing, get this, everybody, totals 18 books. Excuse me, sorry. Major projects he's now developing or that are underway are a musical about Beethoven for the live stage and another focusing on online virtual worlds. He's the recipient of a Community Australia Day Award and basks in the pleasure of family and friends living in Melbourne, Australia, that used to be the world's most livable city, and now it's been destroyed by that premier that I've just been raving about. Daniel Andrews is no longer the world's most livable city, but that's where Ian lives, that's where I live. Ian, welcome to the Mind Medicine Program.
Thank you.
So tell us, how difficult Ludwig van Beethoven, you are doing a musical. Tell us about this musical, and which I understand from you, and because I'm helping you try to make this happen. And dear listeners, you know, if you want to put $1 million into this musical, please contact me. But you know, there's never been a musical made about Beethoven. So tell us what inspired you, what all this is about.
It's pretty simple, really. Music. Music is Beethoven, and music is the centerpiece of the musical that a group of us are putting together now. As our musical genius, Warren Wills, has described it, it's a musical, a compelling piece of music for the theatre, and he regards Beethoven as being the greatest composer of who's ever lived. I've got an open view on that. But I found him in my research and going right back to when I was a young man, a very interesting person. Many, many people, when you mention the name Beethoven, they automatically think he is a person who was deaf, who was extremely grumpy and rude, maybe even misogynistic. That's not the man that I've come to know in my research. It's quite different from that. But the outward signs of the man were probably very similar to people's views. But why was he such apparently a grumpy person, a rude person, a recluse, a person who really shunned society? Well, like many people, he had a major disability, and he found that too great a disability for him to actually tell people about it. So he hid it. And in hiding that, he hid himself more and more from contemporary engagement with his friends and his society, mainly, of course, in Vienna. And the conundrum is that with this deafness and a multitude of other ailments that he had, quote, recurring diarrhea, recurring vomiting, recurring back pain, recurring headaches. In spite of all this, he wrote music like Ode to Joy towards the end of his life. Imagine Ode to Joy, the anthem of the European Union. It's a fabulous piece of music.
Yes, come sing a song of joyful peace and understanding. Anyway,
peace and understanding, yes. And really, as it was promoted when the Berlin Wall came down, the concert was given in Berlin, it was renamed the Ode to Freedom, because the man, as a young man, was in the heart of what we know as the Enlightenment period. The Enlightenment period, which preceded the French Revolution, but the French Revolution really took it to heart. And Beethoven was very much aware of the document itself and lived it. freedom being the great, I guess, the great motif.
And, ode to freedom. Yes, my parents, you know, being refugees from Hungary, refugees from communism. You know, the fall of the Berlin Wall has played a big part in my life, but I wasn't aware that it had such a big factor in Beethoven's life.
It was huge, and one of the things that we need to do when we're writing a musical is to have a recurring motif throughout the play, and with our play, the word freedom or the word free comes about 50 times in a 2-hour play. So it does emphasize it, I hope subtly. We don't want to thrust things down people's throats, but it really did mean a lot to this man.
And what year was he born, and when did he die?
Well, he was born in 1770.
Wow. What an interesting link to Australia.
Well, some of it is, Captain Cook. He died in 1827. So he, in today's terms, was a young man of 57. He spent his formative years in the city of Bonn, which was in those times quite a small town, really. Had about 20,000 people, I suppose, when you compare that with the capital of the Habsburg Austrian Empire, was about 10 times that.
Yep.
So Bonn, 20,000, Vienna, 200,000. So it was a bit of a backwater. It was regarded as a backwater by most, certainly the Viennese, but most people. But it was a place where ideas and music thrived.
In Bonn in Germany, correct?
It is in Germany. It was
okay. Hold that thought, Ian. We're going to keep continuing Bonn in this conversation because we've got to pop out for a short break. You're on TNT Radio, and this is the Mind Medicine Program. My guest is Ian Burns, and I'm Charles Kovess, your host. Back shortly.
TNT Radio's Hervé Morich.
The U.S. mission to China just put out a statement today to American citizens telling them we encourage all U.S. citizens in China to keep a 2-week, 14-day supply of medications, bottled water, and food for yourself and any members of your household. There's a lot to say about China and what's going on. I mean, you're getting tweets such as this one that says some people in China are channeling their inner Tank Man during the protests against COVID lockdowns. It shows the famous 1989 Tank Man, and then it shows below people reportedly in China today, a man and a woman standing, confronting a line of Chinese military or police. It just, everything that's going on has the look of a Western attempt to carry out coup, revolution, regime change, color revolution in China. It just has all of the markings of that. How the COVID zero lockdowns and everything else play into this, I have no idea, but it does indeed smell of the West preparing regime change. And if they're not too careful, this could lead us to World War III.
Hervé Morich on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
Pregnant women never take new medications. They never take experimental medications. And we've never had pregnant women take novel, unproven genetic injections. Something has gone drastically wrong. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Mind Medicine Program. I'm Charles Kovess, your host, and I'm having a conversation this hour with Ian Burns. And in the next hour, I will be with Bob Chemnitz. Now, Ian, we're talking about Beethoven. You are writing a musical on Beethoven's life, and you're telling us he was born in Bonn in Germany, a center of creativity. So keep going. How did Beethoven's life unfold, just quickly?
Well, he had a fairly abusive father who also had a role with the prince, the main person in the ruler of that particular province of Germany at the time. And his father saw the way to wealth, as Mozart's father did, was through his young son. So he was very, very harsh with Ludwig. And by the way, we don't call him Ludwig in the play. We call him Louis because we think that we know him probably as well as he knew himself, if not better. So Louis, for example, would be woken up by his father after his dad had been down to the equivalent of the pub, come home drunk at 2 o'clock in the morning, haul Louis out of bed, take him down to the piano and sit him down there and make him play his scales or whatever he had to do. So it was a fairly harsh environment. His mother was wonderful to him. Unfortunately, she died reasonably young. He was also fortunate in having a kind of a mentor in one of his neighbors, Mrs. or Madame or Frau Bruning, whose son became a lifelong friend of Louis. And we will talk about him a little bit more if you wish to. So he was quite a prodigy. I was going to say a probably. Mm. Anyway, whatever. And he was working in the orchestra of the Elector, which was the prince, playing I think a cello. His father was in that same orchestra. And Louis gradually became more and more involved with the orchestra until he was actually conducting it and playing the organ for state events. And effectively, he became the breadwinner for the family.
Mm. And Ian, I'd love to, you know, that's such an intriguing idea that Louis van Beethoven produced this amazing body of work, and Warren Wills, your musical director for this show, says he's the greatest composer, and you know he's certainly in the top five composers of all time.
Yes.
And yet he had a tough time, and so the one question that I have just in terms of this program and his passion, you know, what's your sense of the drive that was in Louis while he was having all of these physical challenges? What enabled him to keep going?
Well, he actually wrote about this, and at one point, it's actually in 1802, when he was 32, so a very young man, he wrote what's famously called a testament, which he never published. It was discovered after he died. He had written it, obviously, in rough hand, and then rewrote it in fair hand, and then rewrote it again. And then by the way it was written, it appears that he came back to it and added some material to it, which essentially exhorted his two brothers to read it to the public after he had died. And he was saying things about himself and his behavior, which everybody would have noticed, and which were really the causes of his curmudgeonness, if I can use that word. He was a curmudgeon for the rest of his life, but he wanted the people of Vienna and more broadly to understand why he was like that. And a few years earlier, when he would have been about 28, he was actually contemplating suicide. So that's a very confronting position to be in for a person who was obviously very passionate, hugely competent, and increasingly competent. But what got him over the hump and why he didn't take that action was his belief in himself that he had lots of things to do that would be great. So he had huge self-belief, which I'm guessing probably came over as arrogance to many people. He was a person who believed in the equality of mankind. He didn't use the word humankind at that time. A little bit of a contradiction, because most of his income came from the aristocracy. So he was living in the aristocratic world and promoting concepts of egalitarianism and freedom at the same time.
Yes,
so how do you reconcile those? Well,
yeah.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether we can draw out
those. Oh, look, Ian, that's just stop there, because that's a powerful idea, everybody. Having self-belief, how powerful that is, to be able to then break through the challenges and not give up. You know, it's and then you say, well, what if I don't have self-belief? Well, that's another conversation with somebody else that we'll go on to. But Ian, I want to switch there from Beethoven. By the way, everybody, the website, Ian, for the Al Van B musical, please, can you tell us what it is?
It's L, that's a letter L, and you can do capitals if you wish, L-V-A-N, which is the middle bit, L Van B. So L for Louis, Van for Beethoven, and B for Beethoven. LVanB.live.
Just like TNTradio.live. So LVanB.live, everybody. Check it out. Warren Wills, just give us a word or two about Warren Wills. What a genius musical director, musical performer, composer he is.
Well, Warren is one of the extraordinary pieces of luck that I've had in my life. Not far down below meeting my wife.
And what about meeting me?
A little bit below,
Charlie. Don't answer that.
Wonderful. Look, he would have had the ball of his life if he had been born in 1770 as well. He and Louis would have got on like a house on fire. Now, I know that for a fact, because I've seen evidence of the kinds of people that Louis really gelled with, people that he jammed with, people that, if he wasn't walking down the main street of Vienna with, people would say, well, where's so-and-so? So that would be Warren. He is a musical genius. He can play any kind of music. He will turn L. Van B., the musical, into a musical. I can't wait to hear the music. It will be very respectful of the composer, but it will be treated in a new way. I'm pretty sure of that. And I'm hoping, we haven't seen or heard this yet, that there'll be quite a bit of original Warren Wills music. But
okay.
I'd encourage anyone to Google Warren Wills musical director.
Yes, everybody, Warren Wills, W-I-L-L-S. So lastly on Louis van Beethoven is, how big was his body of work? How many compositions in his lifetime, roughly? And then what's your sense in the musical of how many different pieces will be featured, you know, for doesn't matter how long, but what's your sense of that at the moment?
Well, if you go to the wonderful Google, you will find, if you count them, about 700 items.
Wow.
Now, some of those are early works of something famous later on. So it's a bit hard to actually say how many of those were standalone, but it's a lot. How many will find their way into L. Van B., the musical? I don't know. I've got a list of about 40 that I've come to over the last 25 years, which I think could be used. But this is really up to Warren. And at the moment, there's about 30 or approaching 40 songs, some of which are very, very short, some of which are quite long. So it's going to be quite musical.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, everyone who comes to this show when it when it premieres next year, we'll recognize much of the music, and it'll be interesting to see whether we can drive a love of Louis in the younger generation. Ian, well done on this. It's an amazing amount of work, plus your 18 fictional books that you've written. Now, before we go into those other, what on earth made you do all that writing? Because it's very difficult being a writer. I want to talk about education. And for those people listening to this program, and we're talking, you know, about mental health, and we're talking about kids, and we have a real problem of the in our education system, and we have a real problem with the online experience for many people. The many parents despair publicly about what their kids are doing. So what have you done? We talked about it in your bio. You've developed programs as a former teacher. Give us your sense of some gaming programs that you've written for what you see kids need.
Well, the first thing to say about learning, and this is not original, and I would have thought that everybody instinctively knows this, that learning something is best done through a game. If we're talking about developing interpersonal relationships, most of our learning is done on the kids' playground when they're playing down ball or basketball or whatever, when they're playing someone, when they're playing themselves by themselves. That's another way of doing it, of course. But the best way of learning is if you can get that turned into a game. And there's been no time when this has been more so than now, when gaming, and I don't mean gambling, which we don't want to support, but gaming as such means playing games for, in our case, for a purpose. So what we're trying to do, and we've got a project that we've tentatively called Platform One. It's a working title. What we want to do is to use games, and I prefer to use the synonym of quests. We use quests, which are stories, and use them to help people generally, kids in particular, but why not parents and adults generally and grandparents, whatever, to come to grips with the increasingly problematic world that we're facing. And you're very passionate about freedom. I'm very passionate about democracy, which I suppose is, as we see it, much the same. So I see if we move sideways into the concept of democracy, that we are, as a community, under a lot of threat. And my views is that we really need to look at our commitment to the concept of democracy. Everybody have different views of that, and certainly Xi Jinping has a different view from ours, but it's a very important thing. But going back to the quest, how we see this being done, for example, is setting off to save something. There's a nice little game on the net, it's been around for a few years, where you can go to the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne. If you've got the app, when you get to the gate of the Botanic Gardens, the app will know you've arrived, and it'll set you off on a quest. And the quest is to save the gardens from those nasty developers who are going to turn it into a new suburb. So all that we love of the gardens are going to disappear. And there's a pathway to go through the gardens, and you're taken to the first station along the way, and you have to point your camera at a piece of cactus. And when you point your camera at the piece of cactus, what happens? You see little creatures popping out of the cactus, and you think, well, this is really interesting. And then that gives you the okay to move on to the next one, and there's a clue to that. And so you're moving around the gardens, having a good time with your parents or whoever, and you end up, of course, trumpets are blowing, and you have done away with the threat. So that's a very simple one. So what we're proposing is to have whole raft of different levels of this. So you would start off with something very, very simple, and people would be playing that and getting through it. And along the way, there will be little barriers put in to stop somebody just going through and having a lot of fun. There'll be something that will cause him or her to pause and have a little bit of a think, or maybe to leave the computer and go out to the kitchen and say, "Mum, who's the Prime Minister of Afghanistan at the moment?" Oh, so-and-so. Okay, and then he goes back, enters it, and then that allows the person to go on to the next stage. So it encourages questioning, and it encourages cooperation. So if you're going down a more difficult quest, you come to a fork in the road, you've got a choice of proceeding on your own, or you can proceed to the right, which is proceed with a friend or somebody who wants to play with you. You can choose whichever. So I'll choose to go to the left because I think I'm the greatest person on earth. And that's fine. I can proceed for a while. But then sooner or later, here comes a really, really difficult problem to solve. And one of the answers, one of the paths that you are given to choose is, would you like to backtrack and reconsider your decision, earlier decision, not to go with your friend? Or you can choose to continue. And here is a more difficult question. So those sorts of things. So there are values and attitudes that are family friendly, and they rely on the strength and strengthening the community, whichever community we're in. So it's those sorts of qualities and characteristics that we want to put in and encourage. So we're not preaching. We're not trying to throw anything down someone's throat. We just want them to have fun. And by the way, we don't tell them that they're learning something because they know. Well, they know they're learning something because they're proceeding and progressing. So that's what we're doing.
It's a wonderful vision, Ian, and I love making available to kids that I wasn't aware of the Botanic Gardens app. And I really think having games that require younger people to be inspired, to be excited about learning, and this idea that the best way to learn is through games. I've heard that before, but I'd forgotten it. So I'm delighted that you've reminded us of that. Ian, we have to go to a break. You're on TNT Radio. I'm Charles Coves. This is the Mind Medicine Program. And my guest in this first hour is the wonderful Ian Burns. We'll be back shortly after these messages.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
White men need not apply. It's not only happening here in the United States, it's also happening, in this case, in Quebec. A historian at Montreal's Dawson College has filed a human rights complaint over a job posting that's open only to women, Indigenous people, those with disabilities, and racialized groups. The National Post reports that Frédéric Bastien, who specializes in Canadian history, said he saw a job posting for his specialty at the University Laval in Quebec City. But he says the diversity rules disqualified him right off the bat because he's a white male and they're not welcome to apply. Bastien said that if the posting said people of color couldn't apply, it would be totally unacceptable. He says that now racism against white people is actually accepted, and that if anti-black racism is bad, then anti-white racism is no better, obviously. Yes, obviously. But unless more people like Bastien start fighting back against this racism, no matter where it appears, it will become harder and harder to fight. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
There's something about living here. The skies that change right before your eyes. And people that look out for each other. A community that does its bit to plan and prepare to keep everyone safe. Because bushfire is just a part of life here. We've been through it before, and we'll get through it again. We live with bushfire, so we live bushfire ready.
My neighbor is so excited, he just filled up his gas tank for $28. The bad news is it was his lawnmower.
I got the high.
This sucks.
High gas prices blues.
Come on, man.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Mind Medicine Program. I'm Charles Coves, your host. I'm with Ian Burns, the amazing, creative, productive Ian Burns. We've been talking about Ludwig van Beethoven. We've been talking about inspirational games for kids on for kids and older than kids online. Ian, I now want to go to your next amazing project. And, you know, this is the movie that you want to make. So tell us where this idea for this movie came from.
Well, where do I, when I go to schools, people ask me, where do ideas come from? And you can't answer that. But I can answer this one because going back to probably 2007, one of my oldest friends, Laurie Vandenberg, asked me if I could write a book, children's book, essentially, with three major components. One had to be about cricket. One, it had to be about India for obvious reasons. And three, it had to be about Australia. I was pretty confident I could write about cricket and I could write about Australia. I wasn't quite so confident about writing an authentic book from an Indian point of view. Fortunately, and luck plays a great part in life, a few years earlier, I had been in Bangalore as a guest of a Bangalorean. They've changed the name of the city by now, this point in time. And when Laurie asked me if I could write this, I thought, well, it's got to be authentic because it's about cricket and there is a chance that it will be taken up by perhaps an Indian publisher. So I wrote to the host and asked him if he would be my reviewer when I had written something about the Indian side of it. Would he review it and comment on it? Could I ask him questions to make sure things were okay? He said he would do that. So I began writing it. I began writing, obviously, the Australian side of it because that was easy. I like to start something easy where I've got some competence. Then I got down to the stage where I wanted to have a scene set in the Bangalore club. So that seemed to be where the story was going. And so he just suggested, oh, just email them and they'll say that that's fine. So I did, and I don't want to slander Indians at all, but I didn't get a reply. And I didn't get a reply and I didn't get a reply. So I said to him, oh, this is the problem I'm getting. He said, okay, well, contact this guy. His mates know him as Bakhtar, which is short for Bakhtar Savala. So I contacted him and he turned out to be the former president of the Indian Movie Producers Guild. He rode shotgun for Indira Gandhi with the production of Gandhi and the production of A Passage to India. In Bangalore, he was the president of the Bangalore Club. Would you help me with this? Of course he would. He would love to do it. And he was absolutely fantastic. So chapter by chapter, I'd send it to him. He would pass it around amongst other friends. And so really that's how it started, with one of my friends, with another contact, and then that went forward. Now that's... I talked to the Victorian Cricket Association about it at the time of the massive bushfires that we had when 173 people were killed, and I offered the book as a fundraiser for the Cricket Association, which they took up. So I established a bit of a reputation there, and they said they would be delighted to introduce us to the hallowed MCG. If we got to the position of doing a movie.
And by the way, what's the name of the book?
The book is called Ranga Plays Australia. And Ranga, just coincidentally, I am sure, is the name of Bakhtar's son.
Uh-huh.
And my wife and I had the wonderful pleasure of meeting Bakhtar a few years ago in Bangalore and meeting his son, who, when you look at him, you'd think that he should be on the movies as himself. Sadly, Bakhtar died about 5 months after I met him. But a wonderful man. So the movie, we've started writing it. We've got one of our contacts wrote the opening scene, which is wonderful. I've written what could be the end of it, which ends up at the Melbourne Cricket Ground with a huge Bollywood-type dance scene. So it's there, and...
So how much... All we need is a few million dollars for that one, Ian. Is that correct?
Well, it's hard to tell. We've got a couple of wonderful producers here in Melbourne who would like to produce it, but the figures are bandied around with movies, but my guess is somewhere between 8 and 10 to 12 million dollars.
And gosh, this could the big Bollywood link between Australia, India. So anyone listening to this, think, just envision this. Ranga Plays Australia, and it's cricket, it's sport. Look at the interest of the Indians in anything to do with cricket. So, Ian, we've got to keep moving on to my next topic, but it's amazing what your productivity. And the question that I have for you is what are your tips for people? Because many people tell me they want to write a book, but they never get one of those round things called a round to it. How are you so productive with so much writing? What have you found are the disciplines to produce an end product? And I suffer from it as well, because I'm three quarters through a book that I've my fourth book that I've written, but I haven't finished it. So what do you recommend?
Well, Charles, you used the wrong word for me, and that was discipline.
Uh-huh.
I have absolutely none. Never had. Well, I shouldn't say that, otherwise people will stop talking to me. If you want discipline, I've got it, audience. But when I'm writing, I just write because I enjoy writing. My first book, which is called Scratcher, which is, I know, it's very, very funny, began when I was teaching at a food college in Melbourne, of all places. And my head of department used to tell stories about himself as a boy in the small country town in Victoria called Camperdown, and a very large horse, which he and his mates used to use to go out into the country with their ferrets looking for rabbits. And on their way home from an unsuccessful day hunting for rabbits with all the kids on the back of the horse, the horse refused to go back to the town along the road. It went the shortest way to where it knew the oats were, including through a dam. And I thought that was funny. And so that became a chapter in the first book. So no discipline, but interesting ideas. I heard somebody talking, a couple of movie producers talking about a production where they mentioned a burning fire with people sitting around that in the middle of the night looking at the embers burning. There was a story that came out of that little bit of hearsay from a radio program. So it's really because I enjoy writing, but I really do believe that most people have the creative skills, maybe not the skills, but the joy of doing, the ability to do it. It's not something that you should say, I cannot do it.
And do you write, or do you type, or do you write longhand?
I've got a small notebook in my bedside drawer. I've got a small notebook in my car. I've got a large notebook in my office. So a combination of those, but basically I sit at the computer and I type, if I get the first word down, the second one normally comes. So it's the first, or the title. Usually if I'm starting a new book, I write the title. And then if I say blah, 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 that's fine. But if I then underneath it type B-Y-I-A-N-B-U-R-N-S, I'm committed. So that's the only place that where discipline comes in.
Yes.
So anyone can do that, but you've got to make the time. But whether you follow the what other people do, devoting 8 o'clock in the morning to 12 o'clock or whatever every day, that works for somebody. It wouldn't work for me.
So it's because you love it. You know, that's what this is about, finding stuff that you love. But I also, please note, everybody, that having something to write ideas down, that's so important, isn't it? You get a great idea, but half an hour later, it's gone if you don't write it down.
Well, if I have an idea at 3 o'clock in the morning, it's certainly gone by 3:15. So you've got to do it, or I come downstairs and go to the computer and write it. It's got to be done. You can't rely on your memory.
And yes, I've certainly found that. I've had inspiring ideas, and I do a lot of writing. I keep a lot of notes, but I have lost ideas. It's like the universe gives us these ideas, and if you don't write them down, the universe says you clearly didn't value that idea. You know, it's gone.
Yes, yes.
Now, go on.
Gone, probably never to be retrieved.
Well, that's what I found. You know, I can tell whether it's a rehashed idea. They don't come back.
No.
Now,
so, yeah, note taking is important.
No, yeah. Now the I consider you to be a man who is pursuing his passion, and the question, because we're really getting to the top of the hour, is, you know, have you had to face major challenges in your life, or has life been just one blissful ride of success?
I honestly don't think that I have had to face major challenges in my life. So I apologize for that. So far I haven't had crises. But things like prostate cancer, well, that's could be regarded as a major crisis, but I just didn't see it that way. Other things, pre-cancer, I mean, I've got the usual things, pre-cancerous situations in my throat, but the GP looks after it and someone else looks after it. I go to hospital and someone shoves a camera down my throat and has a little bit of a tuck around the tummy, or goes up the other end, and you know, which is not sort of my occupational objective, but these things can be managed now in our society. So I really can't offer any wisdom about dealing with major crises, I'm afraid.
Okay, then the other question that I have for you is, what is a book or two books that have had a big influence on your life? Now, you've written 18 fiction books, let alone the non-fiction. You know, what's a book that really had an impact on you?
I should have thought you were going to ask this one, but it's always asked.
I think it's a very, if you can't answer it, but have you been a reader all your life?
Oh, yeah, well, I've certainly read all my life. I find it difficult to read at the moment because I am just all consumed with writing about Beethoven. But no, there hasn't been a book where I've said, that's it. There hasn't been a song, that's it. There are some marvellous books. The Power of One, for example, is one that comes to mind all the time as a modern classic.
Yes.
Number of reasons.
That's what I was looking for. The Power of One, that comes to your mind. That's the one book won't do it, and we're getting close to the hour. But you know, everybody, The Power of One, I read that a long time ago. I recommend it. I've been with Ian Burns. Ian, I love working with you. I've been trying to help you in your projects on Louis van Beethoven, on gaming, on inspiring games for younger people, and then your movie on Ranga. So, you know, how many grandchildren have you got?
Nine
grandchildren, everybody. So we're coming up to the news. Ian, thank you for joining us. We'll be back after the news with Bob Chemnitz. You're on TNT Radio. I'm Charles Coves. Ian, thanks very much for being with us.